MechCast, Wednesday, August 21st, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you are having a great, wonderful week so far. Looking over the show notes here, have to tell you, we got quite a number of things to talk about and some pretty interesting stuff. We're going to get into iPhones. Of course, we're getting ever closer to the release date of the next iPhones, and we actually might have a date to talk about in this episode. We'll jump into that in a little bit. Talk about HomePod making its way to yet another country, and believe it or not, that same country might be making some displays for the next version of the Apple Watch. We'll talk about that a little bit, and then a big, long discussion on some of Apple's services. We got a lot of information in the services arena, specifically related to Apple Arcade and Apple TV. And that will kind of round out the news for this week. So I guess really not a ton of news, but some interesting things to talk about. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I have feedback from you on Apple and the whole battery lockout, quote unquote, issue, and we'll discuss that term too. You probably don't like it. I don't like it either, and neither does a friend of ours in the Apple media, and I tend to agree with him. We'll talk about that a little bit. Also get into more Apple Card stuff. A lot of interesting information there, believe it or not, and I will give you some impressions on iPadOS, something that I've been playing around with there. I have just recently actually installed the beta. Yeah, it's taken me a little while. And then we'll try and help a listener out with a little time zone thing. Although, to be honest with you, I am a little bit confused on this one, so I might need your help as well. And that will definitely round out this episode of the MacCast. So it should be a good one. But before we dive in, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, longtime sponsor of the MacCast here, Smile, our friends at Smile. We absolutely love them. Want to talk to you a bit about Text Expander. Text Expander, one of my favorite apps. I have it on all of my Macs, all of my devices. Really couldn't live without it. And that's because it is a productivity booster. It keeps me able to actually respond to and handle all the correspondence I get. I often get the same questions, as you might imagine, here on the MacCast, and a great way to handle those is with Text Expander. Pretty much anything that you find that you're having to type over and over again, Text Expander is a tool that can help you with that. You know, your time is valuable, life is short, and constantly retyping the same thing over and over again, yeah, that can get tedious. So why not throw it into a Text Expander snippet? And as a matter of fact, Text Expander is also used by a lot of companies and teams for things like customer support, reports, emails, pretty much anywhere where you would need consistent and accurate communication. You want to control your messaging, make sure it's consistent across your organization. Text Expander is an awesome tool for that too. And best of all, it is fully cross-platform, macOS, Windows, iPhone, iPad, Chrome. They've got support for all of it. And best of all, listeners of this show, you can get 20% off your first year of Text Expander. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast and you can learn more details there about Text Expander. They have great tutorials, great support, lots of great information. So if you're curious at all about it, if you haven't picked up a copy of Text Expander, now is the time to do it. TextExpander.com/podcast, save 20% off your first year. And a huge, huge thanks to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Leading off the news this week, Apple is supposedly dumping the iPhone from the back of the iPhone. This is according to a report supposedly from a Foxconn worker. They are saying that the next iPhone, the iPhone 11, will simply have a Apple logo on the back and no longer the words iPhone. I find this very interesting. Apple, you know, removed the FCC and other logos years ago. So the backs of our iPhones have been pretty plain for a while, but they've always featured the logo and the text. Just the logo and the word iPhone on the current models. If you have an iPhone XS, XS Max, that's what you're going to notice back there. I didn't go back and kind of troll and see what other kinds of information. I know throughout the years there's been various bits of information back there, but with the most recent models, definitely that's all you get. Now we're expected to have even less, and we know Apple likes the simplicity. And I think most people know they have an iPhone and probably don't need the actual text on the back. So I can see Apple pulling this or doing this. I don't think it's out of the question, but will they? I don't know. What do you think about this? The same rumor also mentions a possible new color, dark green. Now, we've been hearing rumors for a while that the iPhone XR update for this year might get a couple of new colors, including green and lavender finishes, and that seems likely, but will they bring green in with the mix of silver, gold, and space gray? That one seems a little bit odd. We do have the product red iPhone, which Apple releases usually later in the year, I think to kind of boost sales a little bit. We talked about this on the iOS show recently, and I thought, you know, another thing that they often support throughout the year is Earth Day, and they will turn the logo at the Apple stores, the lighted up Apple logo, green on that day. So maybe they could release a Earth Day version of the iPhone models, and they could have that be a green color. So maybe that's possibly what's happening. That's pure speculation on my part. That wasn't part of this rumor. This was just that there is a dark green color. I would imagine that that is what is happening here, is that's the color that would be a new color in the iPhone XR, probably along with that lavender. That would be pretty neat. The rumor definitely does parrot some earlier rumors from Ming-Chi Kuo, where he talks about the iPhone glass and colors for future models. He also mentions there that the iPhone glass could have a frosted or kind of matte appearance and texture, which I think would actually be really nice to move away from the super shiny surface and go to a more kind of subtle and tactile finish would be really, really nice, and something that I think would look great on the iPhone. So if they do that this year, I'm all in for that. I think that would be really great. A few other iPhone rumors we're hearing, once again, that the next iPhones are going to retain their lightning connectors, but will come with USB-C wall chargers. And of course, along with that, a USB-C to lightning cable. And this makes a lot of sense considering the fact that Apple is moving all its latest models of Macs to USB-C. So it is probably time to make that switch from USB-A to lightning cables to USB-C to lightning cables. That makes sense. And it'll also mean that we're probably going to get a little bit larger capacity wall charger, something that is larger than 5 watts, so that you can charge your iPhone a little bit faster. So all of these reports make sense, and they kind of coincide with some information from DigiTimes that's reporting that the new models could also have larger battery capacities. They're saying around 3,200 milliamp hours, 3,500 milliamp hours, and 3,000 milliamp hours for the iPhone XS, XS Max, and iPhone XR respectively. So the XS would actually get the largest bump up in terms of overall capacity, about 20% larger, the iPhone XS Max about 10% larger, and the iPhone XR, which already had a pretty nice robust battery, gaining about 2% battery capacity according to reports. But anytime Apple can bump up battery capacity in iPhones, having a hard time saying that word, capacity in iPhones, I think that's ultimately a good thing. People always are happy to have more battery life and fewer need to plug in or drop it on the charger. So that's good. An interesting, albeit skeptical, rumor that dropped this week, it was seeing a case maker already posting an iPhone 11 case, although it was just renders, not an actual case, on their website, saying they're going to sell an iPhone 11 case that would feature an integrated Apple Pencil holder. That's some pretty big optimism there. We haven't even really heard that the iPhone 11 would have its own specific Apple Pencil. This would be a little kind of mini Apple Pencil, according to the renderings. We had heard rumors that Apple could be adding Apple Pencil support, but as I think I talked about on a previous episode of the MacCast, my assumption would be that they would support something like the Apple Pencil 1 and not really have any kind of built-in way to kind of carry that. You would expect case manufacturers to maybe build something onto the side of the case where you could slide it in. This case shows an Apple Pencil kind of holder on the back, so it would just sort of slot into the back. It looks pretty cool because their renders actually show color-matched metal Apple Pencils in gold, silver, and space gray finishes. That would be really elegant and really nice. I like the idea behind what they're putting together, but there's actually no basis in rumor of this actually happening. So I think it's overly optimistic. Was interesting to see. And I think if Apple did do a pencil for the iPhone, it would definitely have to be this little mini kind of short stylus pencil. And that would be a cool accessory. I just don't think it's going to happen this year. What is definitely going to happen this year is that Apple will have some new iPhones to announce. The question always is, when will they announce those? And this week we got a little hint, possibly, of when that event will happen. The dates do seem to line up, and I think they feel legitimate, and they're right around the corner. So they found some references, those kind of wily developers and early beta testers found some references in the iOS 13 beta that show an asset marked, quote, hold for release. And on that asset, it's a graphic asset, it shows a calendar with a date of the 10th, meaning likely September 10th. For the last 7 years, the event actually has been held on or around the second week in September. So that lines up. We don't expect Apple to change that time frame this year. So Tuesday, September 10th, you can kind of tentatively mark that on your calendar for Apple's iPhone special event. And of course, when and if that happens, we will be covering it here and talking about it more on the MacCast. But that's all the latest in iPhone news for this week. If you're living in Japan, I hadn't even realized that you didn't have access to Apple's HomePod yet, but we did get news this week that Apple is set to release the HomePod in Japan on August 23rd. It's going to sell for 32,800 yen, or about $310 US, so a little bit pricier than the $300 or $299 price point we have here in the States. It's also going to debut in Taiwan on the same day, selling for 9,900 Taiwanese dollars, or about $315 US. So also a little bump up in price in Taiwan as well, but not too bad considering how some countries get hit with the Apple tax. And I absolutely still love my HomePod. I think it is a great speaker. I have never regretted purchasing it, and I know many of you like yours as well. So it's nice to see Apple continuing to roll it out into other regions. I am still kind of curious what took so long in getting it over to Japan and Taiwan, but at least starting on the 23rd, you'll be able to pick one up over there. And one other thing kind of in the entertainment Apple audio related area that came up this week, the Porsche Taycan, which is Porsche's new electric car, is going to have Apple Music as a native app in its infotainment system. So no CarPlay needed. I think that's the first time that we've seen Apple partnering with a car manufacturer to put the Apple Music app embedded in their infotainment system. It will also come with a free 6-month subscription to Apple Music. I'm only laughing mildly because free is, I think, a bit of a misnomer. You're definitely paying for it in the price of the car. So don't let them fool you. It is not free. And to have it only be free for 6 months, man, you should get a lifetime subscription to Apple Music if you're buying that car. But cool looking car. And hopefully this is a trend that Apple continues into other vehicles and with other car manufacturers. it's looking more and more likely that Apple could turn to Japan Display for future displays on the Apple Watch. This is a rumor we've been hearing about for a while. Japan Display has made LCD displays for Apple for quite some time, and that's kind of been their focus, but they have been ramping up their OLED display manufacturing, and it is expected that now that they're ready, that they could provide OLED screens for future Apple Watches. As a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo says that Japan Display will supply OLED displays for the Apple Watch Series 5. He thinks they could provide between 15 to 20% of the Apple Watch displays in 2019, but will rapidly ramp up and could reach 70 to 80% by 2021. Ming-Chi Kuo also mentioned in the past that there could be new ceramic casing designs for future Apple Watches, and this week we saw some assets surface in the watchOS betas that seemed to corroborate that. Illustrations of watch backs seem to indicate possible ceramic and also titanium versions of the Apple Watch. Now, Apple, of course, did have a ceramic version, a ceramic edition version of the Apple Watch in the past. That was priced at about $1,500, I think, was around the starting price. I don't know if that's what the plan is this time around, if it will also be an edition. It's looking more like it's just going to be a couple new options and materials. Of course, Apple has the aluminum sport edition now, and the stainless steel versions. Adding both ceramic and titanium versions would definitely expand the line, and also probably the expected price points or the range of price points that Apple could sell the Apple Watch at. Titanium is also an interesting material in the fact that the new Apple Card is also made of titanium, so this may mark sort of Apple's return to titanium as a material for their products. Those of us who have been around long enough do remember the famous titanium PowerBook, which was a great model of PowerBook, beloved by many, many people. So Apple returning titanium to a product, I think, would be welcome by a lot of Apple fans. So it'll be interesting to see. I would expect this is something that they would show off at the next event. And Apple Watch is expected to be part of Apple's September iPhone event, so we could hear more about it on September 10th. And then finally, Apple Watch is just doing really, really well as a product for Apple. As a matter of fact, according to Canalys, Apple now has 37.9% of the U.S. wearables market and has seen their shipments in wearables increase 32% year over year. So Apple Watch doing very, very well. There was some question whether Apple would do a Series 5 Apple Watch, but again, considering how popular Apple Watch is and how well sales are going, I think it makes sense for them to stick to the yearly release cycle of updating new models and releasing new kinds of Apple Watch. It's looking like materials is going to be a big focus this year. We haven't heard too much about potential new features. I would imagine we'd see some additional health and fitness features, and also maybe some updates in terms of the processor and hopefully things like battery life, which I think many people are hoping for in future Apple Watch designs. So again, September 10th, we'll probably hear a lot more about it. And of course, we'll have more coverage here on the MacCast when that happens. This week, we started to finally get some information and some rumors about the possible pricing surrounding a couple of Apple's new online services, specifically Apple Arcade and Apple TV Plus. We're going to start out with Apple Arcade here. Apple announced Apple Arcade as a service back at their special event in March. It's due to arrive this fall, so coming up pretty quickly, and it now appears that Apple is already running an early access program for their employees. Internally, they're charging them 49 cents a month for the subscription. Yep, even Apple employees aren't getting it free. And their testing will end with the launch of iOS 13, which I would imagine would happen shortly on or around or after Apple's event in September. The service will ultimately have 100 titles at launch, but the early access testers are getting access to early builds of just a few games, titles like The Way of the Turtle, Down in Bermuda, Hot Lava, Sneaky Sasquatch, and Frogger in Toy Town. 9to5Mac is reporting that the possible release price would not be 49 cents. That would be amazing. But they are saying it will be a striking $4.99 a month US. That to me sounds like a killer deal, and I think they would get a lot of people signing up. Of course, pricing could obviously change, but that price is amazing. I would definitely opt in at $5 a month to have access to over 100 titles and more as Apple signs up more developers, especially considering the fact that those titles will be playable across all of your Macs and your devices, including the Mac and Apple TV. So Mac, iOS, and Apple TV, you can kind of start playing one place, pick up someplace else. It's going to have Bluetooth controller support. I think it's going to be incredibly fun. And again, at that price point, I think Apple's going to have a lot of people signing up. For the Apple TV Plus, though, on the other hand, Apple is rumored to be considering a much higher launch price. $10 a month. I would presume $9.99 a month, actually. And this information is coming from Bloomberg. They say it's going to launch in November. Again, it was supposed to launch in the fall, but with a, quote, small selection of shows. $10 a month and a small selection of shows. I have to admit, a lot of the trailers that Apple has been releasing recently, and if you haven't seen them, they're available on Apple's YouTube channel. They're impressive. I'm excited about shows like C, For All Mankind, and even the new Morning Show, which just got a really great trailer this week. It looks amazing, but frankly, $10.99 or $10 a month or $9.99 a month, that price point is lame in light of what we already know about the new Disney Plus service, which is going to come in at an amazing price of $6.99 a month. And there you get Marvel, you get Disney, you also get Star Wars. It's like Nerdtopia over there, and at an incredible price. If Apple does want to be competitive in this marketplace, I think $10 a month is not going to be the price point that they need to have. Of course, there's going to be more content coming from Apple, and it's probably going to be some amazing stuff. Apple is really focused on the quality of the shows more so than the quantity. And as you know, and as I've talked about on this show, I definitely appreciate that. Am I going to appreciate it to the tune of $10 a month, though? Going to be a pretty hard sell. There are reports that Apple is again planning to expand their content budget from what they spent this year, about $1 billion on shows, and that it is going to be about $6 billion going forward, but that's still about half of what competitors like Netflix are likely to spend. Apple is definitely going to need to ramp up that budget, though, because we're hearing it costs a lot of money to make these shows. The Apple series The Morning Show, it's reportedly costing Apple $150 million per season. I think they've already signed on for two seasons, so you're looking at $300 million. And considering the fact that its stars, Jennifer Aniston, Steve Carell, and Reese Witherspoon, are rumored to be each getting $1.25 million per episode, getting that star power, yep, that is going to cost a lot. Now, Apple has been rumored to be offering more generous payment terms than some of their competitors, so that is helping them win deals and get more appealing content. But again, competing in this space in terms of getting the content, that is one thing. Competing in the space in terms of getting subscribers, that is a whole different thing. A few other things we're hearing related to Apple's TV Plus service. Apparently, they are going to allow videos to be downloaded for offline viewing, which is a good thing, but there is going to be some limitations on the total number of downloads that you can do, the number of downloads per show or movie, or the total number of times that a show can actually be or movie can be downloaded. So we don't know what those are going to be, but there definitely will be some restrictions. And also, like other services like Netflix, we are hearing that there will be a limited number of simultaneous streams. Again, it's not clear what those limits will be. I would hope that they would be very generous, though, in light of the fact that Apple has been touting their services as family services, so available for the whole family to stream. That means you're going to want at least 3-4 simultaneous streams, and that is not something that you usually get with a lot of services, or something that you generally have to pay extra for. So I will be watching this very closely. I'm curious to see what Apple comes up with, but at this point, I had been very excited about Apple TV Plus as a service. Originally, we thought it was going to be bundled in with our Apple products and possibly free. That would be incredible, and I think would go a long way to Apple actually gaining watchers and viewers of their programs. But when Apple made the announcement of the new service, they definitely said they were going to be charging for it. They weren't releasing pricing. We don't know what it's going to be, but at $10 a month, I'm getting a lot less excited about Apple TV. I'd be curious to know how you're feeling about it. But for me, that might put me off a little bit because I'm going to be spending my dollars definitely on Disney Plus. I may be even giving up my expensive $15 a month HBO to make that happen. And there's just fewer and fewer with all these subscription services, fewer and fewer dollars to go around. And I'm going to want the $5 a month Apple Arcade for sure. So the shows better be really, really good. Of course, I'll probably go in for, I'm assuming they're going to have a free trial. But beyond that, it may end up like Apple News for me, where I try it out and then let it go. So I think Apple is going to definitely have to bring the price point down. I would be shocked if it comes out actually at $9.99 a month. I think $4.99 is probably the right price point. And even better yet, that Apple bundle all of their services into one price. So Apple Music, Apple News, Apple Arcade, and Apple TV Plus, if they could do all that for about $25 a month, that would be huge as well. Regardless of what the price point might be, Cowen analysts think that Apple TV Plus could grab a significant number of subscribers by the end of 2020. They're thinking 12 million subscribers, which I think would not be too shabby. I'd have to compare that to some of the other services, but it sounds like a good start to me. And then finally, one other thing related to this release. We're hearing that Apple TV is probably going to release sometime in early November. That's right on or around the time frame that Disney is releasing their Disney Plus service. They've already announced they're releasing in November. I don't remember the specific date, but I think it is the second week of November. And listener Tony pointed out to me, and I had already kind of noticed this when we heard about the Disney announcement and then I saw the Apple rumor. Both services use the Plus moniker. So you have Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus, and both these services are launching around the same, or possibly, in the case of Apple, around the same time frame in November. Apple and Disney have always had kind of a close relationship, and they have ties to each other. Of course, Pixar and Steve Jobs, and now Lorraine Jobs is a huge shareholder in Disney still. So it is possible that we could see some sort of joint announcement. We do know that the Disney app is going to be available and supported on the Apple TV. So maybe that $10 a month price is a bundle deal with Disney Plus. Haven't heard any rumors specifically related to that, but just going off of the timings and the namings, as Tony pointed out, it does raise your eyebrows a little bit. And it definitely could sweeten the pot a lot in terms of signing up subscribers. Is it actually going to happen? I'm not putting any money on it. I think Apple is going to try to eke out Apple TV Plus with their own $10 a month subscription, and I think they're going to have a hard time selling that, to be honest. Great shows. I think they're going to be amazing, but man, they're banking a lot on that content if that's ultimately the price point. But that is my opinion. I, of course, would love to hear your opinion on this. You can shoot me some emails. Definitely send me some audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, new sponsor here on the MacCast, and I am super excited to have them on board, Mint Mobile, because they can save you on your cell phone bill. Mint Mobile saves money by not having retail locations, not having the overhead of that, and then passing the savings on to you. They provide the same premium network coverage that you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because they handle everything online. They also give you all the services and features that you need without all of the extra stuff that you really don't, which again goes to help cut costs, and they pass those savings on to you. Why would you pay for a bunch of data that you never use? More and more carriers are giving you a ton of data, but if you look at your actual data usage, if you're like me, you're not using all of that. Mint doesn't want you to have to pay for that, so they offer plans with 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of data starting at just $15 a month. Yeah, $15 a month for cell coverage. Unbelievable. And yes, that includes nationwide talk and text. And yes, hotspot. Like I said, all the features that you want. I've been using Mint Mobile and the coverage and performance have been amazing. I've been blown away. Probably not surprising considering the fact that they use the T-Mobile network for their service, but still, it's unbelievable for the price. And you can bring your own device and even keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. And they make sign up super easy. I couldn't believe how seamless the signup process was. They sent the SIM, I got it, I activated online via their website. It was super easy, took just a couple minutes, popped the SIM in my phone, and everything just worked. I was up and running in minutes, and in testing the performance, it was as good or better than what I had before. So totally blown away with Mint Mobile. I think it is a great deal. If you're looking to save on your wireless plan, you need to check them out. You can get a new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free. Just go to mintmobile.com/maccast. That's mintmobile.com/maccast and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/maccast. And a huge thanks to Mint Mobile for their support of the podcast. I believe it was in the last episode of the MacCast where we talked about the new third-party battery replacement controversy, and I'm using that term lightly, surrounding the iPhone XS, XS Max, and XR. What had been discovered, I believe by iFixit, was the fact that, or actually I think it was covered by iFixit, discovered by another YouTuber in China or Japan, that if you replace the battery yourself in your iPhone XR, XS Max, or XS, even with an official Apple battery, it will display a service message when you go into the battery health in the settings and then basically tell you that the repair was not done by an Apple authorized service provider or by Apple and that you will not have access to the battery health features on the phone. Everything else is fine. The battery runs fine. It's not throttled. They don't do anything else to it, but you are essentially locked out of the battery health feature. And so a lot of sites and places were reporting this as a battery lockout. And I just wanted to comment on that a little bit because I think that's going a little bit too far. I 100% agree with Renee Ritchie, who did a great video commentary about this. It's not a lockout. They are not bricking your phone. The battery will work just fine. What they're basically trying to tell you is that, hey, this repair wasn't done by a place that we work with, that we've sort of authorized, and also we don't know about the quality of the battery. And what's going on here is there's a little bit of technology in these batteries. There's actually a chip, I think it's a Texas Instruments chip, that needs to be paired to the device. And only Apple themselves or Apple authorized service providers have access to the software to kind of repair the batteries. not repair in terms of fix, but repair the battery to the phone when you put in a replacement. Now, iFixit, I think, did note that you could remove the chip from your old battery by desoldering it and then soldering it back onto the replacement battery. Of course, that is a big pain in the butt and less than ideal. And so the debate here is, should any third-party retailer or repair center be able to swap out batteries in the Apple, in the iPhone, and you still have access to the full features and functionality that is built into the operating system. Of course, most of us believe in the right to repair, myself included. I think you should be able to do your own repairs, but the question becomes, is it Apple's responsibility to fully support those repairs? And that's where it gets a little bit muddy for me. I think that to lock out the battery health information, that is a double-edged sword, because that can give you a lot of good information about what's going on with your battery. At the same time, I think Apple's ultimate goal is to ensure that you have the best quality user experience, and when they're not in control of that process, they really can't guarantee that. And we do know that there is huge differences in qualities of batteries and the potential safety issues surrounding batteries that aren't well made or repairs that aren't done in a very deliberate and exacting fashion, right? If you have somebody that's just slapping batteries in there, they could potentially damage the battery if they don't really know what they're doing, and that can lead to fire and injury and all these other things. And ultimately, that comes back on Apple, because the news report that comes out is not going to be that this iPhone exploded because it had a shoddy battery or it had a battery replacement job that was done poorly. It's just going to be iPhone explodes and child injured. And that is horrible PR for Apple, and they definitely want to be in control of that. And this is one way they can do that, right? They can, if someone goes and gets a third-party repair and then sees the service message, they're probably going to call Apple or take it into an Apple store, and at least Apple can go in and then inspect that or recommend that they replace it with Apple genuine parts at the store. The counter argument of that to that, of course, is that you're locked into using Apple authorized repair centers and Apple for your repairs, and they tend to charge a little bit more. So, and you not maybe can't do it yourself. So, it is kind of a big deal, but lithium-ion batteries can be dangerous. Now, in a statement, Apple said that the service warning is a feature there to, quote, protect customers from damaged, poor quality, or used batteries, which can lead to safety or performance issues. They also point out, again, that the message does not affect the ability to use the phone with an unauthorized repaired battery. Of course, you lose the valuable and helpful information and access that is provided on battery health with the battery health feature. So I kind of, again, agree with Renee Ritchie that maybe a better way to handle this message is not by locking out the battery health app completely, but every time you open it up, if you have a third-party battery or a repair that was done outside of an authorized repair center, that you just do a pop-up with that same message. So it just becomes annoying. You can dismiss it, but you can still get at the valuable features that are in the software in your phone and get that battery information. So you're constantly reminded that you didn't do an official repair. Yep, annoying, but it doesn't completely lock you out. So hopefully that's something that Apple considers and they look into. Again, a lot of you responded to the original report on this and said it really wasn't that big a deal, which I was surprised. I thought there would be a lot more people who were sort of angry at Apple over doing this. Almost everybody who did kind of support Apple also did say that they do support the right to repair. I think that's an important distinction, right? We're not saying that you shouldn't be able to repair your own devices. We are saying that maybe Apple went a little bit too far with how they're locking out this battery stuff, but that there's probably some sort of compromise in the middle, and hopefully that's where Apple ultimately lands. But I'd love to hear your opinions on this. If you have more thoughts and comments, send those along. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I have to tell you, it is a bit strange being a podcaster who covers Apple and the Mac. The show is called the MacCast because when I started the show in 2004, that's what Apple did. They made Macintoshes. They made computers. Fast forward to the current year, and I would have never guessed that I would be covering cell phones, that I would be covering tablets, wearables, all these things, and I certainly would have never have thought that a big part of my coverage, especially over the last two episodes, would be related to a credit card. Yeah, I know it's crazy, but this is what's happening. And I have some follow-up on the Apple Card stuff that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. First and foremost, I think I said in that episode that you couldn't manage or kind of work with your Apple credit card on the iPad because the iPad doesn't have a wallet app. And there was a rumor that Apple is going to bring a card, an Apple card management app to iOS at some point in the future. Well, many of you wrote in, rightfully so, to correct me and say you can access the Apple card features on the iPad. The way you get to it is through the settings and then through the wallet and Apple Pay settings. And in there, you can tap on your Apple card. The interface is not nearly as nice as what you get in the wallet app on the iPhone. It's pretty utilitarian, a lot of text links and stuff like that, but it does look like most, if not all, of the same functionality is in there. So you can get your balance, you can make payments, you can do all those sorts of things on the iPad. It's just really not as pretty. I much prefer the experience on the iPhone, but in a pinch, if you had to do it, you can do it there. Ultimately, like I said, I think Apple is planning on bringing a better management app to the iPad, and I would expect that to happen around on or around the release of iOS 13, which probably will happen on or around the release of the next iPhone, which is probably 1 or 2 weeks after the September 10th event. So if you're looking for timings on things, that's my best guess. The other good news is that Apple Card is off of its sort of preview mode and open and available to anyone in the U.S. if you want to enroll and get an Apple Card. And Apple also announced that it is extending the 3% cash back offers to third-party merchants. When Apple announced the card, that was going to be on purchases made for Apple products at Apple stores or in Apple online or for Apple services. And we did, I think, on the last episode of the MacCast say it was extended to include your iPhone payments, which are through a different bank, not directly through Apple. And now Apple is saying they're going to let other merchants join in, starting with Uber and Uber Eats. So if you use either of those services and you pay with your Apple Card, you will get your 3% daily cash back on that. And supposedly, they're going to be expanding that program on to other merchants and retailers. And I think that's going to probably happen pretty quickly, given how much coverage and popularity the Apple Card seems to be enjoying. So, companies are going to want to jump on board with that. So I have a feeling that 3% offer is going to just get better and better with the Apple Card. And I'm definitely looking forward to that. More cash back, always a good thing when I'm making purchases. I guess I should mention that I did receive just today my physical titanium Apple Card, and the experience is everything you would expect it to be from Apple. It was fabulous. The packaging, simple and elegant and unbelievable. The activation, just by simply putting my phone near the little near the card, which has an NFC chip in it, or I think the chip's probably in the packaging. Maybe it's in the card. And that went as you would expect. It popped up with a little panel, just like you might see when you're pairing your AirPods. And clicked activate, and bing, bang, boom, it was activated. The card is thick and heavy. It is well-designed, but it probably does need to be protected a little bit. More on that later, because another interesting development with Apple, getting into the credit card business. But I did have an issue in setting up my digital Apple Card with my Series 2 Apple Watch, and I wanted to point this out because it was really, really annoying. I could see when I went into the watch app and I went into the Apple Pay to add it, I could see the card there, but every time I tapped on it, it kept telling me, could not set up Apple Pay, and an error occurred while setting up Apple Pay. And a little Googling and checking online, it was oddly able to be fixed by going into the watch app and changing the language region settings temporarily. So you go into the watch app, go into general, language and region, and I changed it to something different. In my case, I set it to UK, and for whatever reason, it took forever for it to switch over. So if you do this and you notice it's taking a really long time, because what happens is the Apple Watch display goes black, and then a simple text message comes up that says changing region or setting region, something like that. You have to let that run for a very, very, very long time. And it finally switched over, and then I had to go back and repeat it, change it back to US, wait again. And after I did all of that, I was able to add the card without issue. So I don't know what that's all about, some sort of weird bug, but if you encounter it yourself, that's how you can get through it. I was getting pretty close to ready to kind of completely erase and restore my Apple Watch, but luckily I didn't have to do that. And now my Apple Card's in there. I actually used it today. It was awesome, and I was happy to have it on my Apple Watch. Another thing that popped up that we did talk about on the last episode of the MacCast was some people, and I guess this is a bigger deal for a lot of people than I would have imagined, but some people do not plan to get an Apple Card because at the current moment, you can't download the financial data, your transaction data from your Apple Card into any third-party applications like Mint or Quicken. And a listener of the MacCast actually emailed Tim Cook about this and got a reply from not Tim Cook, but from Eddie Q. And he shared the email with me. And I think this is the first place I've seen or heard this information coming directly from an Apple employee. But Eddie Q said in his email, quote, "We are looking at supporting downloads for transactions, but we don't have a date yet." So, not surprising, Apple is looking into it. I'm sure it's a feature they had planned from the very beginning. We don't have a time frame for it, but it is nice to get that confirmation officially from someone at Apple. So I saw a copy of the email. It looks legit, and I think we can expect downloadable transactions for Apple Card at some point in the future. Now, I mentioned that my setup and applying for Apple Card and doing all that was just as easy and seamless as Apple advertised. A lot of you have written in to say your experience was very similar across the board, but I do have to say not everybody is getting the same great, seamless sign-up experience. And unfortunately, one of those folks is Mike, and he sent in this audio comment about how his Apple Card sign-up experience went.
Hi, Adam. It's Mike from Hershey, PA. Enjoy listening to your podcast. Keep up the great work. Just wanted to give a heads up to your fellow listeners about something that happened to me so it doesn't happen to them. With the Apple Card, I got an early invitation. Was told when I was setting up I had to enable two-factor authentication, which I had not had on my phone. So I enabled the two-factor authentication, went through the process, took about a minute, easy. I then had it in my bright mind that now that I have the card, I will turn off two-factor authentication. And so I did. I did get a warning that popped up that said if you turn it off, it said something like some features in Apple Pay you won't be able to use. One thing it did not say, though, because it would have stopped me from turning it off, was if you turn off two-factor authentication, we will cancel your Apple Card immediately. So I turned off two-factor authentication, and lo and behold, my Apple Card got canceled. So I was on with Apple Goldman Sachs support. They could not reinstitute that card. They had to clear some things out of their system to allow me to apply again. I didn't need a new email. I was able just to go back into the wallet app and do it again. So I applied for two Apple cards in the span of about 4 to 5 hours. I guess the only bright spot, not that this is really a bright spot, is I have two titanium cards now because they still sent me canceled one. Not really a prize worth going through what I went through, but this is just a warning to your other listeners. If you turn off two-factor authentication, your card will get canceled immediately. So again, keep up the great work and have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you sending in that public service announcement because I'm not sure that would be clear to anyone. I am a big fan, as you know, of two-factor authentication, so I wouldn't advise turning it off at all. And if you don't have it turned on, I would say you should probably turn it on anyway. Moving forward, Apple is requiring it more and more. I think we're kind of getting forced into it, but I think it is a good thing to be forced into in terms of protecting your data and information, right? You're going to want that on. And of course, with financial data, Apple wants you to have that enabled. My actual suspicion is that two-factor is required because your daily cash rewards go onto your Apple Pay cash card. So in order to do that, and that does require two-factor authentication. So if you have an Apple Pay cash, you need to have two-factor authentication turned on for that. So I don't think Apple Pay actually requires it, but it probably should. And I think, again, it's something Apple is going to require more and more moving forward. So turn it on. I would advise not turning it off. And obviously, here's another big reason not to turn it off, especially if you like using your new Apple card. So again, thanks, Mike, for sending that in. Really appreciate it. Another thing that sort of popped up this week that's a little bit of a PSA too, it was kind of made a big deal of in a lot of the media. I'm not so sure how big a deal it is, but the Apple Card comes with an arbitration clause as part of its terms. So when you're doing the application, it pops up that long, you know, list of terms that you're supposed to read through. Of course, most people don't read through it. But in there is a pretty standard clause that you get with most contracts these days. And it's an arbitration clause, which basically means that you give up your right to sue Apple or Goldman Sachs, whether individually or as a member of a class action. So if that is something that bothers you, if you want the ability to sue them without having to go to arbitration, you have 90 days to opt out of this clause. And you could do that in a couple ways. You can opt out of the arbitration agreement by calling Apple at 877-255-5923. You can send them a letter, a written letter to Lockbox 6112, P.O. Box 7247, Philadelphia, PA 19170-6122. Or you could do it the really easy way and use the messages feature in the wallet app. And it sounds like, Mike, you had to contact support. I just want to do a quick aside here. I contacted Goldman Sachs support with a question after I got my Apple card, and I did it through the messages feature in the wallet app. So basically, you go into the card, you tap on the three little dots in the upper right-hand corner, and then, or you tap on the Apple card, and then you tap on the three little dots in the upper right-hand corner, and you tap on message, and you can get directly to a support representative. And the chat support was fabulous in my case. They responded very quickly. They answered my question exactly as I needed, and they were courteous, and I thought they did a really great job. So I think getting support for transactions and stuff related to your Apple card, your best bet rather than calling, of course you can always call, is probably just to start with going through the Messages app. And that was something that Apple built in. A lot of companies are starting to support messages as a way of doing that. But getting back to the arbitration thing, if you want to opt out and you want to go through the Messages app, you can do that. Just get into the Messages app and then just simply send them a message saying, I'd like to opt out of Apple Card arbitration. And that should be enough to get you out of it. They just need a written notification that you want out of that clause. So there you have it. You know, I don't mind it so much. Maybe a lawyer can tell me why I should mind it a little bit more, giving up those rights. But again, this is a very common clause in a lot of contracts that many of us have probably opted into. So something to be aware of for sure, just so you can make your own informed choice about how you want to handle it. And then finally, related to the Apple Card, I kind of teased this a little bit earlier, but leave it to Apple to create the first credit card that requires care and cleaning instructions. Yep. Apple posted to its website, and I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, an official support article titled How to Clean Your Apple Card. And as you might imagine, it's very similar to maybe cleaning some of your other Apple products, with one notable exception. Basically, use soft microfiber cloths to clean the card. You can add a little bit of water if need be, or in this case, and this is where it varies from cleaning your products, never put this on your other Apple products, but I guess it's okay on your Apple Card, at least according to Apple's article. You can use a little bit of isopropyl alcohol, I would say a very small amount, to kind of wipe down your card. So if you get some, some smudges, some stuff on your Apple Card, clean it with that. It is, for those of you who don't have it yet, it's titanium, but the entire metal surface is kind of covered with a white pigment. I'm not sure exactly what the white material is, some sort of paint, I would assume, or other coating. And that is probably going to get very dirty as you pass it around. I'm also imagining it's something that could become scratched or dinged pretty easily as well. As a matter of fact, this article tells you to avoid getting your Apple Card near anything sharp or scratchy, coins, keys, all those sort of stuff. So don't put it in your pocket with that. Interestingly, it also claims that if you get it near leather or denim, that those materials could actually permanently dye or discolor the card. I think it could actually be pretty cool to have a little bit of distressing on your Apple Card, or a little bit of coloring. It kind of would go in line with the virtual card, which gets colored with the various kinds of transaction spending that you do as you use it. But many people might not want that to happen, so don't put it in your jeans pocket. Don't put it in your leather wallet, which is, again, really strange for a card. I have a feeling, again, leave it to Apple to create a card that's probably going to have a secondary market a support market in third parties making sleeves and little protective cases for your Apple Card. Right now, I'm leaving mine in the white envelope case that it came in, because I don't know what else to do with it. Keep it protected. I'm going to probably mostly use the digital version of the card. And then finally, another thing that is in the care and cleaning of your Apple Card support article is avoid getting it near magnets, because it could demagnetize the mag stripe. Again, something odd for an Apple product, considering the fact that, like, my iPad case has a gazillion magnets in it. So are you saying don't get my Apple Card anywhere near my other Apple products that all have magnets in them? Yeah, it seems a little bit odd. Some of these things are counterintuitive to what the actual, Apple Card is. But there you have it. Support article on how to maintain and keep your Apple Card in good condition. And I have a feeling, it's a beautiful kind of object. I'm going to want to protect mine. I already kind of did a little searching, I have to admit, to see if there's some sort of neat microfiber protective sleeve I could get for it. Nobody's made one yet, but hey, 12 South, maybe you're listening. Yeah, I want something cool to store my Apple Card in and keep it in my wallet without getting stained or discolored, or keep it in my jeans pocket without getting stained or discolored. Sure, they're on their way, and they're probably going to be pricier than you would think, but there you have it. Okay, next thing I want to talk about is iPad OS. I finally jumped in on the public beta. I know public beta 6, it took that long. I think we're not that far away from the official release of it, but I wanted to start trying things out. And overall, it's great. It's got a lot of great new features. We've talked about a lot of them here on the MacCast, but I want to talk to you about one specifically, and that is Maps, the update to Maps, and more specifically, the Apple Street View look around feature. It is unbelievable. It is so incredibly cool. I was blown away at Apple's implementation. Now, right now, it's only available in San Francisco, Las Vegas, or Honolulu. But if you pull up maps of any of those locations, you can access the look around view by dropping a pin in an area, tapping a point of interest, or zooming in and getting to the option. You'll see a little set of, it looks like binoculars that you can tap on to get in the look around view, and then it will zoom up full screen on your iPad. You can move your finger to look around. It's incredibly smooth. It's incredibly highly detailed. The quality of the images blows away most of the stuff that I've seen on Google Maps. It is very high quality imaging. You would expect it to be that way because Google did all of their stuff a long, long time ago. I know they update, but like in my local neighborhood, a lot of the Google images are very low quality still. You know, they're from an older time frame. So those cars only get around to certain areas to update the maps. Apple's stuff looks unbelievable. Completely smooth panning around. You can pinch to zoom in, and the quality is still there. You can get a lot of detail. Of course, faces and license plates, sensitive information is all blurred out, so they do that. And as you move around, you can tap to move down the streets. And this is where it got really cool for me, because I noticed very quickly that if I tapped a little way forward, it didn't jump a set amount. It would actually be relative to how far down the street I was tapping in the image. So if I tapped close to where I was already standing, it would move a little bit. If I tapped a lot further away, say all the way down at the end of the block, it would zoom me all the way down to the end of the block. And Apple does this really cool thing with the zoom where it layers and sort of loads in a slow frame animation the in-between images as you're moving from place to place. So you sort of get this animated effect. They also add a cool little motion blur effect, so it feels almost like video. It's kind of hard to describe. You really have to experience it, but you get this sense of movement like you're actually moving down the street. And they add, of course, those nice little Apple touches. If you try to go kind of sideways on a freeway and there's a barrier there, you'll actually get a flash and a little bounce, a bounce animation, almost like a bounce back. And as you're moving down the street, you're not locked into just one lane. You can actually tap on the other side of the road and it will take you over to that side. You can move back and forth. The moving around is fluid. You can kind of tap around corners and it will swing, the animation will kind of swing you around that corner. As you're moving along and going down streets, you'll see points of interest. It has nice little touches. Like if you tap on a point of interest, it will zoom you there, but it will also point you or orient you so that you're facing the building. So if it's a business, you get the front of that business, and then the panel slides out with all of the other information where you can get photos, information about the business address, phone number, reviews from Yelp, the Yelp images, all that sort of stuff slides up in a slide out panel. And the whole experience is just incredibly well done. Apple really thought out the user experience. You can also, there's a little double arrow when you're in there. You can tap to move into a picture-in-picture view. So going from full screen, the look-around view will get small. It will be moved into a corner, and then you'll have the map underneath. And then on the map, you get a little icon with a set of binoculars, and you can drag around the map and reorient where you are in the look-around view. So you can kind of move that around and then zoom back into that area and then go back into that look around experience. And again, I just incredibly, incredibly blown away by the user experience that Apple put into this and just the quality of the features that are in there. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it in my own town. I believe when Apple launches, they're planning on having it in most cities in the United States. I could be wrong about that, but I seem to remember them saying that. So I think this is going to get rolled out very quickly. They've certainly been driving the cars around and gathering the data for a while now. I think it's been several years And so I am, that's one feature that I'm looking forward to playing around with more. And I never thought I would say that, you know, maps and Street View was going to be the big new feature in iPadOS, you know, especially considering the fact that you've got all kinds of new file support. You've got the neat Apple Pencil tray and palettes, and all that stuff is great. You've got new text editing gestures, which are awesome. All really great features. But after I kind of looked at everything, first experience, first impressions with iPadOS, look around view and maps. Unbelievable. So let me know if you have been using the beta, if you're using the public beta, what features are you enjoying? What are you really liking about iPadOS? Shoot me some feedback, send me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, I'm not going to end the show because I actually have one more item. I almost prematurely ended the podcast for you. Sorry about that. I am no calendar expert by any means, and I'm certainly not a time zone expert. I get confused by time zones as easily as the next person. Maybe you don't, but I certainly do, and I know it can be confusing for a lot of people. You just have to be a podcaster and try and schedule a podcast with people in multiple time zones, and you'll understand how these things get messed up. And Robert wrote in to ask me about Calendar, the Calendar app, and time zones, because he wanted to know if there was a way to completely disable the time zone functionality, meaning that he doesn't want time zones factoring into his calendar appointments at all. He says, I know where, what time zone I'm going to be in, when I'm going to be there, when my appointments are. I just want to set that time and know that when I go there, that appointment is at the same time. I don't want this kind of shifting around in my calendar. And we've all kind of experienced this, I think, in one way or another, if you've been working with calendars in iOS or Mac. And so he says, you know, I have unchecked time zone support in the on the Mac, and I have turned the time zone override off on my iPhone settings, and it's still giving me trouble. Basically, if he puts an appointment in at, say, 10 a.m., he wants that appointment to stay at 10 a.m., regardless of the time zone that he's currently in. It should always say 10 a.m. on his calendar. And so, Bob, I took an attempt to try, or Robert, rather, sorry about that. I took an attempt to try and figure this out for myself. I played around with it a little bit, and I'm sure the community will back me up if I get any of this stuff wrong. But to me, the issue seems to be that time zones in Calendar are handled a little bit differently on the Mac than they are in iOS. But I think ultimately the answer here is you actually want to use time zones in terms of when you enter your events, you want to be able to set the time zone that that event is going to be in. Now, in your case, you're probably going to want to always set it to the same time zone. I think you're in the Mountain time zone, so you'll always set it to Mountain time zone and then set up the settings within Calendar so that never changes dependent upon what, you know, time zone you've traveled to. So essentially on the Mac, with time zone support off, when you enter an event, it will be entered in your current time zone. That means when you travel to a different time zone, it will be adjusted relative to that current time zone. So I think on the Mac, you're going to actually want time zone support on, because when you put time zone support on and you enter your calendar event, you actually get the drop down when you're setting the date and time that allows you to tell it what time zone that event is going to be in. So that's half of the equation on the Mac. You're going to want to always set your calendar events to a specific time zone, probably the time zone that you live in. But you have to do it implicitly using that dropdown when you're setting up the event. The second half of this is when you have time zone support on your Mac, up in the upper right-hand side of the toolbar, you have a dropdown that allows you to override the time zone that you're currently in. So you can implicitly set that to say, I want the calendar to behave as if it's always in this time zone, regardless of what time zone I'm physically in, if that makes sense. So you'll pull that drop down, you'll set it to the Mountain Time Zone, you'll enter all of your events in your calendar on your Mac in the Mountain Time Zone. Those two things will never change when you move time zones, because you're going to have that override option on and you're going to have that setting set. So that means your calendar times will stay at the time that you entered them in, regardless of your time zone. So that's on the Mac. On iOS, you always have the ability to enter your event with a time zone. It's just part of the iOS calendar app. So again, when you enter your events on iOS, you're going to want to make sure you set a time zone and always use the same time zone. And then similar to the way time zone override works on the Mac, you're going to do a similar thing with iOS. The difference is with iOS, when you enable the time zone override feature, I believe in the settings, the calendar settings inside settings, it will ask you to specify a time zone that your calendar always appears in. And once again, you're going to want to set this to the Mountain Time Zone, and then again, enter all of your events in the Mountain Time Zone, and then nothing will ever change. So I think this will fix your issue. And you actually need to use time zone support and time zone override. So time zone support on the Mac and time zone override on your iOS device. And I think if you do that, you're going to be okay. So hopefully that all makes sense. And I explained that well. If anything is still confusing, feel free to email me. And if anybody else has a better way to explain this, or if what I said is totally off the wall wrong and bonkers, let me know that too. Shoot me an email, an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But now, for real, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love to hear from you. If you have an email, an audio comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, shoot me your emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also find show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast by visiting the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And pretty much on any other social media service that you like to use, you'll find me under MacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.